Sort of a little bit of a story that actually one of a group that's sort of largely centered here has contributed a lot to, though I'm not sure if any of them made it today. But are you talking about sort of just sort of collapse from matter to a black hole? Most of this is going to be based on this paper from last November with my PhD student Brad Cowden and former UWinnipeg undergraduate Neil Stepa. But I'm also going to comment a little bit on some other works with Neil's, my current undergraduate Raphael Holt, another former undergraduate Allison Colley, and Gabor Kunstadter at U of W. So just as an outline, I'll give some motivation and introduction to the problem and provide a few of the important details that I sort of want to think about with ADS and sort of background what's known about gravitational collapse in ADS from this point of view anyway. And then I'll talk about sort of the phases of the tidal or what can happen in gravitational collapse, some connections to other work, and then sort of what's ongoing, what we're looking at in the future. So as a motivation, it turns out that looking at gravitational collapse of matter in ADS is sort of an interesting question in several fields: numerical relativity, mathematical physics, and string theory in ADS CFT. So gravitational collapse is a nice nonlinear test case for gravitational dynamics. And the first work on this in asymptotically flat spacetime was carried out by Matt Choptuk back in the early 90s, and then successive papers. And was found as if initially you have some initial distribution of matter, it will fall in. And if there's enough of it, it will form a black hole. Or if there's not, it'll just disperse out to infinity, and that's the end of the story. Near the transition between horizon and no horizon, you find critical behavior. So the initial horizon size follows a power law, at least if you have, you know, say massless scalar field matter. So here is the log of the difference of some parameter minus its critical parameter, and the log of the horizon or the black hole, initial black hole mass plus some constant shift. And you find a nice power law behavior there. And in this case, it's actually got a universal exponent independent of which parameter you're varying. If you have massive matter, say massive scalar field or spontaneously broken gauge bosons or something like that, you find that some initial data has a mass gap. So if the initial energy is gradient dominated, then it behaves like massless matter and you get this power law with no mass gap. If it's massive, you can have a mass gap. But if we try another maximally symmetric spacetime, like Bizon and Rostorowski did in 2011, you find sort of no matter how much you decrease the amplitude or shrink the amount of matter coming in, there always seems to be enough, at least based on their numerical studies, to form a black hole. So this is the initial horizon radius, so proxy of the mass of the initial black hole versus the amplitude. And you just find this sort of repeating pattern of curves. No matter what, as you decrease the amplitude, the initial black hole mass shrinks towards zero, but then you get another repeated pattern. And so the question they asked, or they were surprised by a little bit, is why aren't there some initial data that as you get down to low amplitudes that are stable against horizons, horizon formation? It's actually not all that surprising when we think about ADS a little bit more, but it surprised people at the time a little bit by comparison to the asymptotically flat case. This is also an interesting question when we're talking about evolution of partial differential equations on a bounded domain. So here, even though ADS, of course, is infinite spatially, it's got a conserved energy and a boundary. And the approach that people have taken analytically is to decompose the scalar field into the eigenmodes and just sort of empty ADS without back reaction. So here are the first few eigenmodes on an arbitrary scale. And it turns out that there's resonance because the frequencies are spaced integrally. And so there's secular growth if you do a naive perturbation theory. So eventually you'll find, say, if you just put all your energy initially into two eigenmodes, eventually you'll find some of the higher ones growing and leading to a breakdown of your naive perturbation theory. So this is the phenomenon mathematically known as weak turbulence, in other words, flow of energy to higher modes or smaller length scales. And that's of interest in a number of systems. But there is a high degree of symmetry in ADS, because it's a maximally symmetric spacetime. And in fact, we know that a lot of gravitational behavior in ADS is integrable. And that leads to the fact that you can actually have stable quasi-periodic solutions that are nicely described in a little more advanced perturbation theory in terms of these eigenmodes. And so the real question that's been driving this sort of branch of research for the last 5 to 7 years is just asking which initial data are stable. One just realized that, in fact, not all of them always collapse. What we wanted to do is determine at low amplitudes, are there some that sort of the formation of black holes turns off at a low enough amplitude, and what are those? And I did want to mention also that the techniques, analytic techniques that have been developed to study gravitational collapse in ADS have recently been applied more to other systems. So for example, Biasi et al. Have a few papers talking about applications to the Gross-Pitevsky equation, describing a Bose-Einstein condensate trapped in a harmonic trap, just as an example of something else that you can use these kind of techniques for. So it's sort of spreading out into other fields of physics a little bit. But I think for this audience, sort of the motivation might resonate a little bit more is ADS-CFT. We know, of course, if we have global ADS, then we have a CFT on a spherical boundary and the black hole corresponds to a thermal state. So maybe it's not so surprising that if we have a thermal state of a CFT on a closed, you know, manifold or a sphere, and we add a little bit of energy to it, it should pretty much always thermalize, right? It's got to be some interesting or special distribution of energy on the CFT if you're going to put it in, and it's not ever going to thermalize. Okay. The question then is, so this is related to work on maybe more general quenches of ADS where you have sort of a black hole or a hot CFT and you're adding energy to that. You might ask, well, how long does that energy take to thermalize? By perturbing a black hole horizon, and of course, Rob and other people here have worked on this, that's related to hydrodynamics, and it's qualitatively like ion collisions at RIC or the LHC. Okay, so that's our perturbed black hole horizon in ADS. So that I like to think of as having a hot cup of tea, stirring it, and then watching the temperature of the tea increase a little bit because of the kinetic energy you've added. You're starting out close to equilibrium. What I'm talking about today is putting matter in what's otherwise empty ADS and asking how long does it take that amount of energy or matter to form a horizon or heat a vacuum state up to some sort of thermal system. So here's my absolute zero. That was from my house one April. But the question again is what distributions or initial distributions of energy here are going to thermalize and how long is it going to take? And this is really more of a far from equilibrium dynamic question than if you were starting with a black hole and perturbing the horizon a little bit. Here we're really going to just put in matter and empty ADS, there's no horizon, and to ask sort of when a horizon forms or what happens. Okay, so I probably can go through this fairly quickly for this audience. I'm just going to remind you of the main part of ADS geometry that's important. for this this process look a little bit at sort of what wave motion with the full gravitational back reaction looks like, say for a scalar field in ADS, and then just give you a description of sort of what I mean by stable versus unstable in gravitational collapse. So here's the metric I'm going to be using for asymptotically ADS space. The radius is given by tan x here. So the boundary is going to be out at x equals pi halves. And as we know, a massless wave can start at the origin or the center of ADS, get out to the boundary in pi over 2, and then bounce back to the origin in another pi over 2 with no, you know, there's no dispersion or loss of energy to infinity. This is sort of the key feature of ADS, right? It has a boundary, and we typically take sort of Dirichlet boundary conditions on it. That's for massless fields. Massive fields don't actually get all the way out to the boundary, but they certainly don't in finite time. But the nice thing about them is they feel a gravitational potential sort of near the center, so they don't actually get all the way out to the boundary at all. They still sort of, if you have a distribution of massive field at the center, they still move out, get sort of as far as they're going to go, and collapse back in also a finite length of time. That turns to be similar to pi for the massless fields in a lot of cases. Let me just describe these coordinates a little bit more detail. These are Schwarzschild-like coordinates adapted for, you know, forming a Schwarzschild black hole. A here is, again, some function of x and t, since we're working with spherical symmetry, that indicates horizon formation when it vanishes. The function delta here basically just tells you time dilation between, well, t is the proper time at the origin with the gauge choice you've chosen. So delta tells you the time dilation between the origin and wherever you are in terms of that conformal time t there. There's going to be an additional function that's going to come up, m, that tells you the sort of the mass enclosed in radius x. So m prime is just the mass in a shell of fixed radius at x. The original studies by Bazin and Rostorowski and most of the work that's been done have been in ADS-4. I'm going to be talking about ADS-5 partly because of just interest in 4D CFTs, but also because it turns out that there are more stable solutions in lower dimensions. As you might expect, ADS-3, for example, we know there's a mass gap in the black hole spectrum, so if you go to low enough amplitude, definitely can't form a black hole because you don't have enough energy. ADS-4 is sort of more of a boundary case. There's no mass gap, but there's still a lot of stable solutions. And it turns out that adding a mass to the scalar field also increases the parameter space of the initial data that's stable. So to provide a better contrast between the stable and unstable cases of initial data, we're going to ADS-5. Where things tend to form black holes a little bit more readily. Okay, so I'm going to show you some sort of very low resolution videos of some scalar field evolution, again, with the full gravitational back reaction. And so these are, I'll start with just a massless scalar and go through the whole thing. These are evolutions that form a black hole. And the reason it turns out that ADS looks like it's generically unstable is that even if you have a small amount of matter that can't form a black hole as it initially collapses, it tries to disperse out to infinity. But as we've said, there's that boundary. And it gets there in finite time. It reflects off the boundary because of the Dirichlet boundary conditions, and it comes back in. And now it's already been focused a little bit gravitationally by trying to collapse the first time, so it's a little, that shell of matter is a little bit more dense. So it gets another chance to form a black hole. If it still doesn't form a black hole that time, it just goes out. It's been focused a little bit more, so it bounces back and it gets yet another chance. And that process just can repeat until you get dense enough or focused enough to form a black hole. So these particular videos are going to show you Black hole formation after two bounces, so on the third attempt. I've labeled the sort of the first movies as field evolution. They're actually the evolution of the canonical momentum to the field. It's a little bit easier to sort of run the simulations if the initial data is set up with the field itself zero and the sort of an initial profile or non-trivial profile in the canonical momentum. So that's what we're going to start with. So this works out. All right, so you see there's an initial pulse like this that travels out to the boundary and back and forms a black hole. Oops, where did I go? Okay. That's what it looks like. The video doesn't go quite that far. That's what it looks like right before the horizon forms. You can see that the field profile gets really compressed and spiking near the origin. Oops. Okay, this video is gonna be the evolution of that M prime variable. So essentially the mass or energy distribution in the field. And again, you'll see it start out in sort of one lump near the center, try to collapse, travel out to the boundary and back a couple of times before forming a black hole. Like this. And again, it's trying to get really spiky and right near the origin just as it forms a black hole. I'm not sure what would happen continuing the evolution. We've got a couple of subpulses here. Some of the matter might actually still be ingoing and just increase the size of the black hole right away. But there can actually be cases where our horizon is sort of approximately forming. And I guess I should say this is numerical. We're not actually going to that A equals zero horizon formation because that would take an infinite amount of time, both from the ADS boundary perspective, but also in terms of computing power. So we cut it off at some small value of that horizon function. So what can happen is some of this outside pulse can actually be outwardly moving and it can take a while to bounce back and fall in. Okay. For the same simulation, this is that horizon function A, and you see it's pretty close to one for most of the evolution. And as it comes in right before forming horizon, it starts to dip down a bit more. And what you get is a spike down below, well, as small as the numerical tolerance is set. This is particularly, these are low resolution for simulations, so it's not particularly low. Okay, and then just for comparison, this is the evolution of the mass distribution for a massive scalar field profile. It's going to collapse in sort of the same length of time, so two quote unquote reflections off of infinity, although here you'll see it doesn't actually get all the way out. Sort of travels as far as it can, it's caught in some potential well and then comes back. Okay, so this is all these simulations, well, at least our sort of research level ones are done on Compute Canada resources. Again, you see the spike in the mass distribution there. And so this is all numerical evolution of the Klein-Gordon equation. And in spherical symmetry, Einstein equations are just constraints, so they're easy to calculate. Okay, so here are the two kinds of behavior we've been talking about or interested in. And again, we're starting with Gaussian initial data in the canonical momentum of the scalar field. And those Gaussians have some width sigma. We're looking or trying to understand the behavior of the dynamics as a function of amplitude of this initial data. These are examples for massless scalars, so scalar field mass mu of zero. And they're sort of two basic cases. One is stable evolution, so if you have a high enough amplitude, what we have here is the time to form a horizon in that origin proper time as a function of the amplitude of the initial data, so at a width of 1.5 in ADS curvature units, at sort of large amplitude, black hole forms right away. And if you were to look at the size of those black holes, they would be large black holes, sort of larger than the ADS scale. But at smaller amplitudes, it takes longer to form those black holes. And you start getting smaller and smaller black holes. And then all of a sudden, near some critical value, the time to form a black hole just jumps up from about, I don't know, 10 or 20 in ADS units to 100 ADS units. And then in the length of time that we're considering for our numerical calculations, it doesn't form a black hole at all. So the red triangle is a lower limit. We can't say that that amplitude never forms a black hole, but we know it doesn't in a long time at least. So this is sort of typical of what we would call stable evolution. If you have enough matter in there, sure, it forms a black hole, but at low enough amplitudes or small enough amounts of matter, it just all of a sudden stops. Unstable evolution, on the other hand, as long as we sort of keep turning down the amplitude, if we run the simulation long enough, it still forms a black hole. So we have a black hole time of formation out to long periods of time. The key thing in identifying that it's an unstable evolution, though, actually comes back to perturbation theory. You can argue that at small amplitudes, if you do form a black hole, the time to form a horizon has to scale like the amplitude to the minus 2. And this just has to do with the fact that if you look at the Einstein equation, the back reaction comes at order epsilon squared. And so if you then go back to the Klein-Gordon equation, you have your order epsilon for the linear behavior of the field, and then the back reaction comes in at epsilon cubed. So any serious deviation from just pure oscillation has to be in two powers of epsilon down. So in this, how we can convince ourselves that this evolution looks like unstable evolution in the perturbative regime is we said, well, okay, let's look only at amplitudes where the black hole forms after a fairly long time. So we picked, in most cases, 60 ADS units. And we'll do a fit to see sort of if this follows, well, not a power law, but a shifted power law with an epsilon to the minus 2 scaling. This particular fit is really a simple one. It's not even a best fit. Just took these two data points at sort of the largest values of epsilon we considered and calculated naively, if we fix the power of epsilon to minus 2, what are these coefficients A and B? And that's the red curve. And you can see there's a fairly decent agreement between the data points and just the red curve fit that way. In this case, it's not even a best fit. It turns out for this one, the best fit is something like epsilon to the minus 2.08 or 2.1, something like that. Okay. So I'm going to talk about sort of what the phase diagram looks like if we have a massive scalar. And the nice thing about having a massive scalar is we can pretend we're, say, condensed matter experimentalists, where we're tuning temperature and magnetic field on our sample. Here we can tune the initial width of the initial data and the mass of the scalar field. So we have sort of two handles. We can actually look at a phase diagram. And then I'm talking a little bit about some of the phases. There's the unstable and stable phase that we talked about that we expect even from perturbation theory and can see there. But there are also a couple what I would call non-perturbative phases. It's unclear if this sort of behavior they have would continue or persist down to arbitrarily small amplitudes, but at least at what should be smallish amplitudes, they have sort of some unusual behavior, so I'll describe those. Okay, so this is the phase diagram. And what we have here is the initial width on the horizontal axis of that initial data. So again, all the initial data is a Gaussian profile in the canonical momentum for the field. So just the width in ADS units. And this is the mass of the scalar field. The solid blue dots that you see sort of at the narrow range or the wide range are unstable solutions. The empty dots in the center are stable solutions. So this has been dubbed sort of the island of stability. In other words, we expect generically, as you go to sort of arbitrarily small or arbitrarily large widths, no matter what your mass is, you'll have an unstable solution. But there is a sort of island of stable solutions in the middle. What's a little bit hard to see, and unfortunately just because I can't make this plot quite big enough, there are some half-shaded dots on what I like to call the shoreline of the island of stability. So there are two non-perturbative phases that we'll talk about in a little bit. One that looks like it may be stable or unstable, but if it's unstable, it takes longer to form a black hole than expected, so that's a metastable region. And there's what we'll call an irregular phase, and you'll see why when I talk about it. The key takeaway from this phase diagram is that the island of stability tends to get larger and larger as the scalar field mass gets higher, and it also shifts to the left towards smaller widths. We've actually got some idea why that happens, and I'll talk about that later. And then again, the other thing is if we're sort of doing numerical simulations, we can see what I think of as these non-perturbative phases. Okay, so just looking at the unstable phase a little bit, this is where formation of the horizon or black hole formation extends into the perturbative regime, and from scaling arguments in the perturbation theory, we therefore expect it to continue to arbitrarily small amplitude. Here I'm plotting again the horizon formation time versus the amplitude of the initial data. And we're going to fit the shifted power law, A e to the minus p plus b, for the horizon formation time. And we do that fit only for calculations or evolutions with only with large th, so we guess that we're in the perturbative regime. And if that power p is sort of within, you know, statistically, in terms of standard deviations, close enough to approximately that perturbative expectation, p equals 2, then we'd say this is a perturbatively unstable width. Because we're doing this fit, we can also look for the behavior of these parameters A, P, and B as functions of the field mass and the initial width. For most of those, we don't get sort of much information out of it, so wouldn't even bother to talk about it. But at small widths, so sigma less than or significantly less than the ADS scale and smaller than that island of stability, then independent of the field mass, that parameter A scales approximately like sigma to the minus 2. So it looks like the inverse square of the width. And so putting this together, if it's epsilon to the minus 2 and sigma to the minus 2, it looks like the time of formation for a black hole actually depends only on epsilon times sigma in this regime. I'm not entirely sure why that should be, but why it's independent of mass is, I guess, because in this regime, it seems like the energy is gradient dominated, at least initially. I do want to say that there's some caution about this. Quality of the fit is not very good. It's got a large chi-squared. That seems to be driven by a few just a couple outliers, particularly this one for a very large scalar field mass. So it might just be that we haven't gotten to sort of a small enough width to get a good fit. So not entirely sure about that, but we thought it was an interesting enough plot by eye to speculate about it. There's also a metastable phase, non-perturbatively. So here are a couple of examples, one for a scalar field that's got a mass of 5 divided by the ADS radius, and one that's massless scalar with widths of 1.7 and 1.8 in ADS units. So these are the stable and various metastable and irregular phases tend to be at widths sort of similar to the ADS scale. Here we're doing that same best fit of the horizon formation time against epsilon, but we're finding that the power is not close to epsilon to the minus 2. It can be, you know, epsilon to the minus 2 point something, but the statistical error is pretty small, so we can say it's different from 2, or it can be as large as, you know, 3 or 4. So there's some for some reason it just, you know, at the smaller amplitudes, it's taking longer to form the black hole than you'd expect. And it might just be, in some cases, that this particular amplitude, it does get into perturbative instability, but we've got to just go down to lower amplitudes before we get that good epsilon to the minus 2 fit. Or it could be a case like this, where all of a sudden it appears that the black hole stopped forming, or at least there's a large jump in the horizon formation time at small amplitude. So in these metastable phases, we don't know if they might be stable or unstable at small amplitudes, or even if possibly this sort of metastable behavior continues all the way down to arbitrarily small amplitudes, where it keeps forming a black hole, but slower than we predicted from the, you know, the lowest order perturbation theory. Most interesting one is what we're calling the irregular phase. This is one example at a fairly small scalar field mass. What you see is black hole formation pretty fast. When the amplitude starts getting small, you get this sort of jagged curve, not really curve, but for the black hole formation times. You can try to do that same power law fit for that, but it's never a good fit. The reduced chi-square is always very large, like a few hundred. Okay, it's no sense really described by a power law. That's sort of less interesting than maybe this non-monotonic behavior, which also occurs. This is for a mass of 5 and a width of 0.34. So here, you get a little spike in the black hole formation time, then it comes back down and grows again, and then maybe becomes stable here, or at least has another big spike. This kind of behavior wasn't really commented on, but you can see it in a couple of places in some of the earlier literature on this, including some of the work done here by Louis Lehner and Alice Buchel and collaborators.
Gotcha.
Yeah?
Do you have a sense of what the error bars are on the simulations?
Yeah, they're probably smaller than the dots. I mean, sorry, the error bars are calculated by the simulation in terms of the numerical error are very small. You do have to worry about, are you having resolution problems? So as the field sort of passes through the origin, the profile can become very spiky, then you can essentially lose energy in between grid points, right? Then you might have problem where you think it's taking a long time to form a black hole, but it shouldn't be, because some of your mass has disappeared sort of non-physically. In previous papers, we've looked at behavior like this and did convergence testing, so matched runs at progressively higher resolutions, and got the same results with the progressively shrinking errors as expected, and those were fine. So because it's the same behavior that we've seen previously, we're pretty confident in this kind of result. Okay, but yeah, that's actually been a big issue in some of the literature too, is making sure that the numerics are behaving properly. This is another behavior that we see, particularly at large masses. This is at for a scalar field mass of 20 times the ADS unit. It looks kind of chaotic, right? It goes along and there's some of this non-monotonic looking behavior over here, maybe, and then just kind of jumps around randomly. And we've seen this before as well. For this paper, it was the first time we'd seen it for a massive scalar, but chaotic behavior like this has also been seen in a couple of other systems. A massless scalar with Einstein-Gauss-Binet gravity in ADS-5. That was work that I did with Gabor Kunstadter and Nils Deppe and Allison Cauley. I'll come back to that. And also, there's another group that looked at two just shells of matter that interact with each other only gravitationally. And those also exhibited chaotic behavior like this. And so I'll give you a little bit more evidence why this is really chaotic. And in fact, that non-monotonic behavior from the past previous slide is also a little bit chaotic. So there's a lot of interesting looking sort of behavior non-perturbatively sort of near that island of stability. So it's a really rich system, sort of surprisingly so compared to when I started working on this. So I want to look at that chaotic behavior a little bit more carefully. This is from, I think, this plot. Might actually be from here, not sure. But basically, we're gonna look in the chaotic region and find three amplitudes that are close to each other, but where the horizon formation time sort of jumps around. And we wanna look at sort of a Lyapunov exponent for them. So this is the magnitude of the Ricci scalar at the origin as time progresses. I'm actually taking the upper envelope of the Ricci scalar because as the field bounces back and forth, of course, the curvature at the origin is going to shrink as the field goes out toward the boundary. So this is the sort of the maximum Ricci scalar as a function of time for each bounce. And look at the difference in that Ricci scalar between the three amplitudes as a function of time. That's this plot. This is a log plot versus time. So you see it's definitely oscillatory behavior in the differences, but there is sort of a weak exponential growth in there. There's a reasonable arc coefficient, and in particular, there's a statistically significantly different slope compared to zero. So statistically, there's a non-zero Lyapunov coefficient or non-trivial exponential growth sort of underneath those oscillations. And that's true in the cases that we saw that sort of look chaotic by eye. Those have sort of larger Lyapunov exponents. But even in this case, there's a very small but statistically significant Lyapunov exponent in these three amplitudes here. So even that case is sort of very mildly chaotic, at least right around that peak. This is not super surprising in the case of a massive scalar because there's, you know, that field mass gives an extra length scale. You can see that maybe there's something changing there. But we also found evidence for chaotic behavior for a massless scalar. And this is sort of the first evidence of chaos in this type of gravitational collapse in a theory with sort of without an additional scale. So we found that to be interesting as well. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about connections of this work to previous work. So we know that there are a number of stable solutions based on initial data that looks like a single perturbative or linear eigenmode of ADS, variously known in the case of real scalar oscillons, in the case of complex scalars, boson stars, or in the case of sort of pure gravity, gions. And these are known not only to be stable if you just sort of set them up and go to low amplitude, they don't collapse. You can show sort of perturbatively that you can remove the secular growth. But you can also start with, you know, a big oscillon and add a small perturbation to it or a little wave on top of it. And that wave will sort of go back and forth on top of the oscillon and never cause gravitational collapse. That's been done numerically. So it's known that these oscillons are non-linearly stable. And as I mentioned, there's sort of a more general way to perturbatively describe them beyond just sort of saying, well, it's a single eigenmode. And what does that have to do with that phase diagram? Well, we noticed two features of it. One is that the islands of stability moves to the left or to smaller widths at larger field masses. And the other is that it seems to get larger at higher field masses. And here's sort of a heuristic explanation. So what I have here done is I've plotted the lowest eigenmode, the J equals zero eigenmode, both for a massless scalar, that's this wide one, and for a mass of 20 scalar, the narrow one. And you can see that the single eigenmode gets narrower at larger field masses. So you might think, well, okay, that's a reason that if maybe the stable solutions are sort of anchored to these single mode oscillons, if the single mode is getting more and more narrow, then that would drag the island of stability a bit more toward the narrow widths. The other thing, it's a little bit hard to see here, but the dotted curves, sort of on top of the solid curves, are actually what I would take if I take a Gaussian distribution and try to fit it, like find the best fit width and amplitude to that single mode. Right? I notice that the mode looks kind of Gaussian, so if I just sort of put a Gaussian on top of it and try to find the width that fits the Gaussian the best, or that fits the Gaussian to the single eigenmode the best, it's hard to see on this plot, but there's a bit of a deviation for the massless case and not very much of one for the higher mass case. And we can see this a bit more quantitatively here. These are spectra. So I take that Gaussian that's the best fit to the J equals zero eigenmode. And I now take that Gaussian and I decompose it and find how much of it is in the other eigenmodes. It's not purely the J equals zero eigenmode. So how much is in J equals one, J equals two, and so on. And there's a whole bunch of curves on top of each other. These are all the masses that we looked at below one in the ADS units. And these curves that get progressively lower are the higher and higher mass scalars. And what we see is there's sort of less of a contribution to that sort of single mode Gaussian at higher and higher masses. So in other words, at higher and higher masses, not only does the single eigenmode get better, or get more and more narrow, but our Gaussian initial data becomes a better and better fit to a single mode. And so you can imagine, well, then maybe, you know, extending the width a bit of that Gaussian, you stay closer to that single mode for longer. So that's sort of our heuristic or physical understanding for why that island of stability gets larger and moves towards narrower widths at higher and higher masses. Okay. Something, and again, I think a lot of this comes from the group here and also a group led by Ben Kraps, is if you look at a sort of improved perturbation theory, you find that there are actually several conservation laws. So not only is energy conserved as it is in the fully nonlinear theory, but there's also a conserved particle number. And that combination of conservation laws means that the energy can't just flow to higher and higher eigenmodes or smaller and smaller length scales. In other words, that weak turbulence cannot happen sort of unimpeded in the perturbation theory. You have to have if you have a cascade of energy to higher eigenmodes, eventually you'll have an inverse cascade back to lower ones to satisfy both of these conservation laws. So we can see this happening in energy spectra. So here's a stable evolution, and what you see here in the bottom panel is the energy of the individual modes for the first few modes. So this is the J equals zero mode. You have J equals one, two, and so on, up to I think four or five. These are cumulants, so this is everything in J equals zero. The next line is everything up to J equals one, everything added up to J equals two, and so on, in powers of two. And so what you see here is that, well, energy starts to go into the higher modes. There's less energy in J equals zero plus J equals one, but then it flows back. Right? So that's that inverse cascade. And for a stable solution, you just have sort of an endlessly repeating series of cascades of energy to higher modes and then back into the lower ones. Meanwhile, for an unstable evolution, the energy, sort of no matter how high the number of modes or how many modes you're adding together, as time gets closer to the horizon formation timer when a black hole forms, that cumulative drops, meaning there's more and more energy in modes higher than that. So there's now sort of becoming a significant amount of energy in modes higher than J equals 8, 16, 32, so on. Okay. And if you were to draw the spectrum right before we measure horizon formation, you actually find something that looks like a power law. And that's indicative that sort of all of the modes start contributing to physical quantities. There's sort of enough in them. We can look at these non-perturbative phases and see what's happening. So for this particular example of metastable evolution, it actually looks a lot like the stable evolution, that you've got the cascades of energy into some higher modes and then inverse cascades back into lower ones. There are some sort of higher frequency oscillations on top of it. I'm not entirely sure what that means, but at least for this particular case, it seems to indicate, well, maybe metastable evolution is a little bit closer to stable evolution than we would think. This is one of those chaotic looking irregular evolutions, and the energy spectrum, or the time evolution of the energy spectrum doesn't really tell us much either. It seems to be just going crazy. There's clearly cascades and inverse cascades, but it's very different than any of the others. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about where this chaotic behavior might come from and how it relates to previous work that has found chaotic evolution in this gravitational collapse question. What's the mechanism for it? So previously in literature, there's been a sort of a two-shell model. So Brito et al. Actually, like I mentioned before, set up for their initial data, and their matter, they said, I've got two transparent, infinitely thin shells of matter that are going to be able to interact with each other and transfer energy between each other gravitationally only. So every time these two shells of matter pass each other, one going in, one going out, they trade some energy back and forth. What they found is there's chaotic behavior in some regions for the initial conditions because the two shells would keep passing energy back and forth, and neither shell would ever, the horizon only formed when a single one of the shells happened to have enough energy to form a black hole by itself. And because there's this sort of almost random passing of energy back and forth, you get through a chaotic evolution. You never know ahead of time when one shell is going to have enough energy to do that. And then some work that I did with UW collaborators, we also found that the same kind of chaotic behavior was happening in the collapse of matter in with Einstein-Gauss-Binet gravity. So we were just trying to understand what would happen in, say, a CFT with different central charges. And there's also chaotic behavior. And what we found in looking in detail at the solutions, this is, again, that M prime, in other words, the mass or energy distribution in the field, is that even though we started with an initial Gaussian pulse, after passing, you know, trying to collapse a couple of times, there'd be two fairly thin spikes of matter. And as they pass through each other, again, these shells of matter would exchange energy with each other. And so it seemed to be the same kind of evolution that Brito et al. Found, that the collapse was driven by getting enough energy into a single shell to form a black hole. So our initial guess was, well, maybe something like that is happening with the massive scalar, but when we went to plot the mass profile in a couple of cases, we didn't see two shells at all. What we saw was sort of one big lump, or one in both cases, with maybe a secondary wave on top of the main pulse. So here, there's a big lump with a little shoulder on it. And if you watch this as an animation, you see the shoulder sort of move back and forth across the big lump as the big lump sort of wobbles around. And so, here, there's a little spike on top of the big lump. And again, the big lump wobbles around and the little spike travels back and forth across it. So the main pulse doesn't really fragment, but there seems to be a secondary wave on top of it. So maybe, again, this is sort of speculative, maybe you need constructive interference between sort of two, or the initial, the main wave and sort of a secondary wave in order to get black hole formation. I'm not quite sure about that. It's a different mechanism. Okay, quickly, just to look at sort of what my group has ongoing, with Brad Cowden again, that's my PhD student and our collaborator at Nils Geppa, we're looking at the perturbative theory a little bit, and we want to understand sort of in more detail the behavior of the quasi-periodic solutions of that perturbative theory that's sort of building on work that was done here, or largely here, partly here. Brad is working on sort of completing or describing this perturbative theory for massive scalars. It's only been written down in detail for massless ones, so looking for any difference there. With Nils Deppa and my undergrad student, Raphael Holt, we're looking at what happens if you force the scalar at the boundary. So rather than having some initial distribution of matter pumping it in from the boundary, and it's sort of a bit more like what you would think of doing to the CFT. This is related to sort of old work by Bhattacharya Minwala and Awad et al., but also more recent work by Carasedo et al. Carasedo et al. Have sort of really nicely demonstrated how to have stable solutions that are pumped at the boundary sort of at all times, and how to pump the boundary to create sort of boson star or oscillon solutions starting from nothing. So it's definitely related to that. And then also with Holt and actually other students coming in, we're trying to move beyond spherical symmetry, particularly in the perturbation theory. That's an area that's becoming a bit more of interest the last year or two. Should be even possibly richer than we've seen already. So there's a summary, and thank you for your attention.
When you're referring to chaos, this is over some finite time scale, because eventually the system does thermalize.
Well, Not necessarily, right? There are initial data where it seems to never thermalize, and that's to do with the fact that these are, generally, they're supersymmetric CFTs. Some of them are integrable, so there can be particular initial data that are not ergodic.
Just a scalar in ADS, right?
Well, this is just scalar in ADS, but the ADS itself is so symmetric that there definitely are some initial data that are purely stable. I don't know what happens sort of at low amplitudes for like the chaotic phase, although I suspect they're probably stable at arbitrarily small amplitudes. But yeah, the chaotic behavior is sort of in finite time evolutions.